Welcome to the Central Assembly Podcast. It's our prayer that this message is an encouragement and blessing to your life.
Well, the Faith and Science intro video finishes and the lights come up, and this is not Pastor Jim. So I don't know who this is worse news for, you or me, but I think time's going to tell, right? Pastor Jim unfortunately had a prior commitment that was kind of on the books for a long time tonight, and so he's not able to be here, but he did not want to take a break from the series, so we put it together that I would take this week. And it's not totally out of left field. A lot of you may not know that actually my collegiate background is actually in math, and I started out in chemistry. I have a minor in physical science with some emphasis in chemistry and physics. And kind of ended up on a wild path to be working here as a pastor, but I'm not the only one, apparently, right? So it's not totally out of left field. Of course, I'm not a rocket scientist. You know, I think on most church staffs, a math degree would kind of make you the bona fide math and science guy, and here all it's good enough for is a very distant second. But it is still second, so here I am tonight, right? But being the math guy, I thought we would maybe start out tonight talking a little bit about numbers. We're going to get to the speed of light here in a little bit and kind of relate it back to some of what Pastor Jim has talked about in some previous weeks. But we've also thrown around some really big numbers in the series. And sometimes it can be very hard to kind of wrap your brain around how big some of these numbers are. So I thought we would just look real quick at the bigness of some of these numbers. Is bigness a word? It is tonight. I'm a math guy, so I don't really care, right? So when I think about abstract things that are hard to maybe wrap our head around, I like to put them in terms of things that are familiar. That helps me kind of be able to maybe see at least a way to think about some of these things that otherwise are kind of abstract. So let's start, we'll look at the number 1 million. 1 million is a big number. It's one of the smallest numbers we've kind of talked about here. There it is on the screen. Math guys like that little 10 to the 6th up there. What that literally means is write down 10 six times and put multiplication signs in between. And if you're tracking with me, you can see if you know how multiplying by 10 works, we'll get a 1 with 6 zeros after it, right? And that's 1 million. Well, how big is a million? You know, we hear a million. It's not maybe not that big. What would be a way we could think about this? Well, I was thinking maybe a good way to think about it is through the passage of days of time. You know, so the oldest living member of my family is my grandfather. He's almost 89. So as of today, I did the math on this. He's been alive for 32,454 days. He's 88, almost 89. 32,454 days. That's a lot of days, but it's not nearly a million. You're not even 5% of the way to a million. So how long is a million days? How many years is a million days? Think about it in your mind. You got 2,740 years ago is a million days. If you wanted to have lived a million days, you would have needed to have been born, extrapolating out the calendar, on November 12th, 721 BC. I don't think any of you made it. So 721 BC, if you're a Bible scholar, you know that's about the time that the Assyrians were invading the northern kingdom of Israel. You can read about that in 2 Kings in your Bible. That was a million days ago today. Today. Maybe not the invasion, but that year was a million days ago. So that's big. In fact, days aren't going to work because that's too far back. We're going to run out of days. So what if we think in terms of a million seconds? You know, imagine if we were counting to a million and we counted one number per second, one number per second. Slow at the beginning, but as you get bigger, you know, you have to talk fast to get that in there. How long would it take you to count to a million one number at a time? It would take you 11 and a half days. 11 and a half days. So if you wanted to finish right now, I actually did the math based on 7 p.m. So if you wanted to finish at 7 p.m. tonight, didn't know what time I'd get up here, you would have had to start at 5:13 a.m. two Saturdays ago, Saturday, September 29th, 5:13 a.m. That would give you a million seconds from now, right? That's kind of manageable. That doesn't seem like that long ago. It'd be a long time to count without sleep or eating or anything. But in my mind, that's kind of doable. What if we switch it up to a billion? Billion. We're just changing that little 6 to a 9. We're hanging some more zeros on there. But they're zeros, right? They don't mean much. Zero. And then it's changing the M to a B. That's a small change, right? How long do you think it would take you to count 1 billion seconds? 1 billion seconds. Anyone want to? You can shout out a guess if you want to. 31 years and 8 months. 31 years. You would have had to start, if you wanted to have lived a billion seconds, if your birthday was Sunday, February 1st, 1987. Congratulations, you have lived a billion seconds today. And let's take it up to a trillion. Again, just a few zeros, right? How long do you think it would take to do a trillion, count to a trillion? This is astonishing. It's 31,710 years it would take to elapse a trillion seconds. It's mind-boggling. Like, that's actually hard still to wrap our head around. So let's take this lens and look at just a couple of the numbers Pastor Jim has talked about, right? Remember a couple weeks ago he talked about in biology, he said that the word length of a DNA structure, you know, in letters, it has 3.5 billion letters. How long would it take for us to count those, counting one a second? It would take 110 years and 11 months. To finish today, we would have needed to start it in 1907 to count those. You might say, how did they count those? Well, they didn't use one person. They had a big team. The first week of this series, Pastor Jim mentioned that there's 200 billion, with a B, stars in our galaxy. And our galaxy is kind of small by galactic standards. 200 billion stars. To count those, it would take you 6,337 years. If you run that back, you'd have to start in the year 4,320 BC. That's kind of the beginning of recorded history. Like, you would have to be counting for all of human history just to get to that number that's the source. And Pastor Jim did say it was give or take 100 million, so give or take 3 years off of that. Give or take 3 years. And then my favorite, and we'll move on, there's 10 trillion cells in the human body. Remember we mentioned that? So if you remember what we said about trillion, 10 trillion cells in the human body, counting one per second continuously, no breaks, would take you over 317,000 years. Can't even say what that would look like. So big numbers are big. If you want to be really depressed, remember that as of today, the national debt in the U.S. is $21.4 million. So it's more than twice that if you had to count out that national debt in once. So maybe we should just stop there and pray. But, right, what have we done? Well, that's kind of fascinating, and we're going to introduce another big number tonight here in a little bit. We're going to talk about the speed of light. And, you know, light's a really fascinating topic. We experience it every day. We kind of have some intuitive knowledge of that, and it shows up in Scripture a lot. In fact, it is the very first thing that we see God create in Genesis chapter 1. In chapter 1, verse 3, it says, "And God said, let there be light, and there was light." And from that moment on, light and us have kind of had a very interesting relationship. You know, we see light actually through the Bible. It's a great thing to do a word study on if you want to try that sometime. You can see it all over the place. It shows up as a motif in the book of Job. It shows up in about 26 of the Psalms. It's kind of all over the Bible. But we want to zero in on just one use case of it tonight. And that is, that's what I think is one of the most fascinating ways it shows up too. It's in the book of John, and actually twice in the book of John, Jesus says, "I am the light of the world." We see it for the first time in chapter 8, verse 12. It says, "When Jesus spoke again to the people, he said, 'I am the light of the world, and whoever follows me will never walk in darkness, but will have the light of life.'" And it shows up again in chapter 9, verse 5. And then John even writes about it some more in 1 John chapter 1. So this idea of Jesus as light shows up quite a bit in Scripture, and it's kind of fascinating. Why did Jesus choose to say, "I am the light"? In fact, when he says, "I am the light of the world," this kind of tidbit, it doesn't really tie into what we're talking about tonight, but the word for world in that phrase is cosmos, which is related to the root word of cosmology, which Pastor Jim talked about the first week. So we even see a bigger definition of that. The Greeks generally used it to describe the world that they knew, and they used it as cosmos. But why is it fascinating? Why would Jesus pick light and maybe not something else? Well, this is a very fascinating thing, and it even fascinated Albert Einstein. Albert Einstein, you know, he was a Jew. Pastor Jim talked about this. He was a Jew by birth, but he was, in practice, he was an agnostic, right? And he actually, we talked about how that kind of informed his science and got him messed up one time. But he was very much an agnostic and not real interested in the idea that God would be at work in the world. But here's something he said in an interview with the Saturday Evening Post back in 1929. He said, "As a child, I received instruction in both the Bible and in the Talmud. I am a Jew, but I am enthralled by the luminous figure of the Nazarene." Think about that for just a minute. Let's think about why, you know, even an agnostic is fascinated that Jesus would choose to relate himself to light. Well, let's think about why that might be. Light is pretty incredible, right? We've all experienced it. We know kind of from our experience that it displaces the darkness. We get up, it's dark, we turn on the light, the darkness goes away and we have light, right? That's probably the way we all experience it. There's nothing overly scientific about that. There's all sorts of other scientific properties of light that make it really interesting. In fact, we could probably do a whole series just kind of unpacking the nature of light and some things related to these kinds of verses. But we're going to zero in on one thing in particular, just one facet of a variety of a very fascinating topic, and that's the speed of light. The first thing we recognize about the speed of light is it is really, really fast. It is really fast. Pastor Jim mentioned it a couple of weeks ago. He said that the speed of light moves at 186,000 miles per second, right? So that gets it around the world 7 times in 1 second. 1 second. So that when we were counting to a million, the first one of those light's already been around the world 7 times. So, and this is a good time to maybe think about what speed is, you know, because we're going to be talking a lot about speed. It might be good to have a firm grasp of what speed is. Speed is kind of an interesting quantity because we always express it in a number, but the number is always relating two concepts, right? Speed, the equation for speed is distance divided by time. So speed is always telling us the relationship between a distance that something travels and the duration of time that it takes to travel that far. Makes sense to everybody? That's easy. So when we say a number for speed, we're really talking about two things. We're talking about a distance and a time. So let's talk about 186,000 miles per second. There's a distance, 186,000 miles, and there's a time, 1 second. We don't really use miles per second very much, so it's hard for us to kind of understand what that is. It's not super useful in the world around us because 1 mile per second would be 3,600 miles per hour. That's what we talk about more. You know, that's probably the one we engage more. We drive our car, we don't have our speedometer saying miles per second because that would not make much sense because we're not going that fast. We think about miles per hour. So through a simple math conversion, we can convert the speed of light from miles per second to miles per hour. And this is an astounding number. This is another one of those big numbers. But when we work out the speed of light at miles per hour, it comes out to be 671 million miles per hour. It's a little faster than my car, right? That is fast. That is fast. Now, we've kind of rounded on both of those numbers to make it a little easier to talk about. But 671 million miles an hour. So light is fast. You know, in the world here, it's instantaneous. We don't ever turn on the lights and see the light slowly move, you know, toward us. We turn on the lights and it's there. We had a thunderstorm last night. You know, you see the lightning flash immediately, but the thunder is delayed because the lightning is almost instantaneous in the space that we're in. But if you measure it, it's moving 671 million miles an hour. This bigness is not actually the only thing that is interesting. In fact, it's kind of the tip of the iceberg. The real fascinating part about the speed of light is that the speed of light is always 671 million miles an hour. Now, I got to give some caveats, or there'll be two people with pitchforks that come after me later. Light speed can change based on the medium that it's in. But what is constant about light speed is when you're inside a system, it doesn't matter what your point of reference is, it's always the same. And in the vacuum of space, which is where we see light able to travel that kind of distance most frequently, you know, there's not 671 million miles to work with here on Earth, right? So we got to go somewhere else. So in the vacuum of space, that's what the speed of light is. So we're kind of using those numbers from the vacuum of space to be the numbers we're working with. But even if it's slowed, like if it's moving through a solid, it'd be a little bit slower when it's moving through air. And when it's moving through air, it's a little bit slower than when it's in a vacuum. But regardless of what it's in, however we observe it, if we're all part of that same system, the speed never changes. And it's easy to kind of say that, but again, this is one of those kind of non-intuitive things that we need to think about a little bit. So kind of doing the same thing we did with the numbers, let's maybe think about a way that we can understand something about this. So I like to think about it in terms of baseball. Any baseball fans? Anybody enjoy? But maybe not. This might be a terrible plan. I guess everybody's baseball team around here is done. So, but next year. But, you know, if we see pitchers throw a baseball and we understand that speed, you know, when we throw a baseball, if one of the ways we could measure that speed is if we knew the distance between the pitcher's hand and the catcher's mitt and had a stopwatch, we could know that distance, divide it by the time that it takes, and that would give us the speed. We don't usually do it that way because that's a little complicated, that we use a radar gun and it just checks, uses radio waves to check on that. But we all kind of have seen baseball played. We've seen baseball pitchers throw, so this is something we can kind of think of. In fact, to kind of set us up a hypothetical example, because what good physics talk, you know, what good is a physics talk without some random crazy hypothetical, right? Let's imagine somebody throwing a baseball, and to try and make it as least abstract as possible, let's imagine a real guy throwing that baseball. In fact, my good friend Steve Goss is sitting right back here. Steve, stand up, wave at us. Everybody get a good look at Steve. Steve was one of the top pitchers at Evangel when we went to school together. And his best pitch was his curveball, but he had a pretty decent fastball. He could throw it low 90s pretty consistently. And so we'll imagine Steve. Imagine Steve with the catcher. The catcher has a mask on, so we don't care who he is. And we don't know who he is. But imagine Steve throwing the baseball, and we'll just make it around 90 miles an hour. We'll cheat him a little from college Steve, but probably rounding up a little from what present Steve can do, because we're not as young as we used to be, right, brother? So we'll imagine Steve. So everybody kind of see Steve. You imagine him throwing a baseball. We got a radar gun. It's going 90 miles an hour. But what physics hypothetical is complete without a train, right? So let's put Steve on top of a train car. We got a train track. So everybody imagine this. You got a train track in front of us. We got an engine on that train. We got a train car. We're going to put Steve on the back of that train car, throwing toward the front of the train. He's got a catcher up there catching. Everybody have this in your mind? This sounds ridiculous, doesn't it? But it's going somewhere, I promise. So Steve throws the baseball. We know he throws 90 miles an hour. So when the catcher sees that baseball coming at him, he's on top of the train. The train is stopped. He sees the baseball coming. How fast does he see the baseball coming toward him? This is not a trick question. It's 90 miles an hour, right? And let's say we're standing on the ground, and we notice this guy. How do you not notice a guy standing on top of a train throwing a baseball? So we watch him throwing the baseball. What speed do we see the baseball going at? Again, not a trick question. Yeah, good job. You guys are on this tonight. 90 miles per hour. 90 miles per hour. Well, now let's get that train moving some and see what happens. If we fire up that train, and let's just assume that the track is really smooth and the train engine is really smooth, and there's something stopping Steve from perceiving the wind moving past him as he's going through the air, because that would mess with the reference point of this. But let's imagine the train's going 100 miles an hour. And if it's truly going in constant motion at 100 miles per hour, Steve and the catcher will almost be oblivious to that motion. They not almost will be, they will be, because they just see the train moving. They don't feel any change. So they're moving 100 miles an hour, and they probably don't even know it if they don't have some other reference point to tell them that, if they're not watching what's going on past them. So now the train is moving 100 miles an hour. Steve is on that train. He and the catcher, they're both moving along at 100 miles an hour. And Steve throws that baseball. He throws a 90-mile-an-hour fastball. What does the catcher see coming at him? 90 miles an hour. Yeah, 90 miles an hour. It's not that hard, right? What do we see on the ground? We see the train with Steve, the catcher, coming by at 100 miles an hour. Steve throws the ball. How fast do we perceive the ball moving with respect to us at the ground? 190. Yeah, everybody's following this. This is good. So 190 miles per hour. And sometimes this is a little hard to think about. We don't spend a lot of our days thinking about baseballs and trains and motion and how motion affects things. So just take a minute. If you think this through, this makes a lot of sense, because we're observing the motion of the train across the ground added to the motion of the ball across the train. So you add those two together, 100 plus 90, 190. Everybody with me? All right, we're going to make it a little more weird. We're going to take away the baseball. We're going to give Steve a flashlight. And he's going to aim his flashlight at the catcher, and we're going to measure the speed of light coming off that flashlight. Easy enough, right? So we stop the train. We're back stopped. Now it looks even weirder to us, because we just see a guy shining a flashlight on top of the train. So, of course, we're going to watch that. Steve aims the flashlight at the catcher, and he turns it on. How fast does the catcher see that light coming at him? He's got to look fast, because it's coming 671 million miles an hour. So it gets there. So it's going the speed of light, right? Train stop. We look from the ground. What do we see? Same thing. Just like the baseball, right? This is easy. 671 million miles per hour. Well, now let's fire that train up to 100 miles per hour again. Okay, everybody have the picture of that in your head? Steve turns on the flashlight. What does the catcher see? Steve and the catcher are moving along 100 miles an hour. So they see, just like the baseball, speed of light is unaffected. So they see the light moving at 671 million miles per hour. Here's the weird part. What do we see from the ground? We would expect to see the same thing with the baseball. You add those two things together, right? This is not what we see. Somehow, even though for the baseball, they add, when we see the light coming off the flashlight, we see it also moving at 671 million miles per hour. That's because the speed of light, this is what we mean when we say the speed of light is constant regardless of your reference point or your state of motion. Inside a system, the light speed is constant. This is really hard to wrap your head around, right? In fact, if we introduced another train, let's say there was another train track and you were on a train that was approaching Steve's train at another speed, we'll say 70 miles per hour, your motion state would affect the way you saw every single piece of that system we've talked about. Steve, the catcher, the baseball, us on the ground, the other train, except the speed of light. The speed of light would be the same for you. Even though you're coming at him this way, I'm standing still, you know, down here, Steve's going, we all three observe the speed of light the same way because it is constant regardless of your vantage point or your frame of reference. I can see some of you are already thinking ahead of me. You're going back to John 8 and Jesus saying, I'm the light of the world. One of the things we see from this is we all get the same Jesus, right? I don't have some better Jesus because I'm the pastor up here tonight. And Pastor Jim doesn't get like super Jesus because he's, you know, the senior pastor. We all get access to the same Jesus, regardless of our state in life, the position we're observing from, how we're looking at him, anything. We all get the same Jesus. This is pretty fantastic. But this is not the most fantastic thing. And to really think about that, and this is going to get maybe a little harder to track with, but to think about that, we have to think about, go back to the idea of what is speed. Speed is always a relationship between a distance and time, right? There it is. It's that equation, pesky math again. The only way that the speed of light in that example can be constant for me on the ground, for you on the train going one way, for Steve on the train going the other way, the only way that speed can be constant is if somehow distance and time are different for all three of us. I mean, this makes no sense, right? This flies in the face of everything that we've experienced, because if we think about time, I mean, what could be more absolute than time passing, right? Well, what can be more absolute than time passing is the speed of light. And this is a result that makes no sense. This is what Einstein realized. I heard one physicist say, this is the realization that makes Einstein Einstein. Like, we probably aren't talking about him the same way without this discovery along the way. And this is what is the basis of relativity. This is the same thing Pastor Jim talked about last week. Actually, Einstein preferred to not call it relativity. He preferred to call it invariance theory, because that describes the speed of light. What's relative in this situation is time and space, because that has to happen for the speed of light to stay constant. This is a very hard thing to wrap our head around. Jan Levin is a physicist at Columbia University. She's a frequent contributor to NOVA on PBS. I'm an armchair scientist, so it's okay for me to like NOVA, right? And some people look down their nose at that, but I like it, and my kids like it, so we watch it. And she's frequently on there. She's kind of known as being a black hole expert, which kind of gets into some of this kind of topic. So in one of the NOVA specials on PBS, this is the way she describes this quality of light as it relates to space and time. She says, to respect that absolute quality of light, time has to cease to be absolute, and space has to cease to be absolute. And those two have to become relative in such a way that they slosh between each other. I really enjoy that, because slosh is not a very scientific word, right? So this is a high-powered physicist, and the best way they can come up to describe this for us to understand is that they slosh. This is wild stuff, right? But when we think back to Jesus saying, I am the light of the world, I am the light of the world, when we look at that statement through this relativity lens, there's a whole new richness there that maybe we didn't see 5 minutes ago. Because what Jesus is really saying, he's not just saying, I'm the same for everybody. He's not just saying, I'm like the nightlight in your room when it's dark to give you comfort. He is saying all of those things. The other thing that he's saying is that I am so constant that the very things that you perceive to be unbending and unyielding melt into the consistency of water in a bucket to preserve my nature. That is fantastic, right? I mean, think about that. The very things that nothing seems more absolute in our own experience than this space that we're in is the space that we're in. And the time that we're ticking off is different. But what this tells us, and this is scientifically observable, it's been verified over and over again. I'm up here walking around, you're sitting still. Time's ticking a little bit different for me than it is for you. Pastor Jim talked about the airplane thing. We don't perceive it very much. If we could go faster and we're working with bigger sizes and various things, if we had bigger masses, you would see this and it would probably become as intuitive to us as anything else. But we don't get to see that in our regular reference, right? We see this idea that time is rigid. But science tells us that's not the case. It can't be the case. Because the speed of light is what's absolute. The speed of light is what's rigid. And Jesus said, I am the light of the world. You know, the writer of Hebrews picked up on this way before Einstein did. He said, you know, Jesus Christ is the same yesterday, today, and forever. And that's a powerful thing to think about. And the but this constancy means even more than just the sameness. I think that's the thing that has struck me as I've gotten ready for this. This means that the constancy of light demands that everything else yield to it, right? The things that seem like they're bigger than us, again, they slosh. They turn into the consistency of water and they move around. You know, maybe that's the diagnosis you got last week. Maybe that's the situation at work you're dealing with. Maybe it's something going on with your kids. Those things don't seem more absolute than the passage of time, right? I mean, the passage of time seems bigger to that than me, at least in my life. Well, Jesus is helping us see that even the passage of time has to just melt to accommodate him. So those other things, yeah, they're probably not that big of a deal when we are thrown in with the light of the world, right? And there's, if this can get even better, it gets a little bit better for us. And this is kind of maybe the closing thought we're going to try to end on tonight. And worship team, you can come and maybe start to play. In John 12:36, Jesus says, this is just a couple chapters after he said, I'm the light of the world, twice. He says this, believe in the light while you have the light so that you may become the children of the light. So if you were wondering, is this really for me? Yeah, there's great news here. All we have to do is believe in Jesus and we become children of the light. Many of you have done that. You're a child of the light. I'm a child of the light. If you haven't, there'll be an opportunity for you to do that here in a minute. But as I've been thinking about this and preparing for this the past few weeks, I've been really struck by the question, what does it mean to be a child of the light? What does that mean? Sorry. Am I living my life in a way that I'm acknowledging that? There's days I do, and there's days I probably need to do better. It's easy for me, some of you who know me will laugh at this, I can get fixated on kind of the worst case scenario. It's part of, I jokingly say it's part of my job here as the risk management guy. But, you know, there is a difference between being prepared and letting your life be gripped by fear and worry and living scared. And I would submit tonight that if we're living as children of the light, that's not how we live, right? We live in a way that exudes confidence, not in ourselves, not in what we do, but confidence that we are serving the light of the world. That's what I want. Is that what you want today? Yeah. Let's bow our heads and we'll wrap up tonight.